It's a pleasure to be here with you and share some of my photography. This is a great audience because I understand everybody here is a photographer or has a great interest in photography. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, great. And my finish is a little rusty. Otherwise, I would. But so, if you'll just indulge me, I'll speak in English. I have a presentation. I'd like to keep the whole thing really informal. And if anybody has any questions about my photography or me or whatever, we'll do a kind of a Q&A at the end. But feel free just to ask me just like that. I wouldn't, it's not like a formal thing. So basically, my whole ambition in life from when I was 19 since then was to travel and to just see the world and everything in it. I found that photography was kind of a vehicle to allow me to kind of live a life without having to really work for a living. just to kind of, you know, travel around and take pictures. That seemed like a kind of a great thing to do. When I was 19, I lived in Europe for a year, and then I went to school, and when I was in college, I traveled to Africa and different places, and then started working for a newspaper in 1974. But I really just, I saved my money because my real ambition was, again, to travel and work for National Geographic. So I went to India and spent 2 years there, just 2 years. And at the end of that 2 years, I came back home and took my portfolio, my pictures, to National Geographic. And as luck would have it, they gave me an assignment. And basically, that assignment was in 1980. I've been working for them continually. My last story was in the February issue of National Geographic. It was a piece on nomads in India. So most of the stories I've done for National Geographic, I don't know, it was probably 30 or whatever, have been my own proposal, have been stories that I actually wrote the idea and the description of the story and then turned it in, and then they would either say yes or no. But most of the time they said no. But if they said no, I went back and kind of redid it or proposed another story. And I didn't want to work on their stories. I wanted to work on my stories. I wanted to think of places and situations that kind of interested me. And so what I did was, as it turned out, that most of those ideas and places were kind of in Asia, sort of between Afghanistan, India, and sort of like Burma and Cambodia. So my whole, although I did work in, I've worked in Europe and Africa and South America, most of the work I did was in that one region. And so in a way, my kind of body of work now kind of has a kind of a thematic kind of unity to it. So this was actually an Afghan girl in Peshawar, Pakistan, who was a refugee. She had these really kind of beautiful eyes, as this other one did as well. This is the Sharbat Gula, the picture which actually ended up running on the cover of National Geographic. And it was really one of these you know, kind of amazing situations where, you know, the light was right, the background was right, the expression was right, everything kind of fell into place. And a very rare kind of, usually there's some element that's not quite kind of coming together. But there was just the right mixture of these things, which kind of really worked. We had so many letters, people wanting to know, you know, how they could help her. They wanted to send her money and, you know, clothes, and wanted to marry her. It was just an amazing outpouring. So we eventually, I kept looking for her over the years, but in 2002, we made this really concerted effort to try and go back. So we had a couple of translators that we had help us. And we just took her picture around all over this refugee camp, asking anybody if they remembered her, or, you know. And the amazing thing was that we found that there were a lot of girls who were claiming to be her. This girl swore to us that she was the Afghan girl, and that she remembered me, and she was so happy to, you know, to see me again. And in fact, she even convinced the film crew I was with that she was the one. But I kept telling everybody, but you know, look at her eyes. Her eyes are completely different. I mean, how can she be the? So eventually, somebody we met said, "I remember her brother, and let me see if I can find her brother, and then maybe that'll help lead to her." So after a couple days, this fellow wanted him to meet us, and we got very excited because he said that, you know, the Afghan girl is my sister. And you know, we looked at his eyes and we thought there's a good chance that this could be we could be onto something here. So anyway, he brought, you know, eventually he was the brother, and he brought in, this is this is Sharbat Gula, who at this point was about 30 years old. And we were quite shocked at, because we kind of expected, you know, a 12-year-old girl to walk through the door. And instead it's this, you know, girl who's 30 years old, but you could see that she had really lived a hard life, and that life, that hardship was really evident in her face. Anyway, this is, and she was married. It's her husband who worked in a bakery, made like, you know, €1 a day or less. But the great thing was that she was alive. We have been told for years that, you know, she had was dead, and she had been killed, and so we were really, you know, happy that we she was still. So this is her and her one of her children, and husband and brother. So the magazine wanted me to shoot a cover for the magazine, so I asked her to hold a picture of herself. And I only got about 5 or 6 pictures, and then she kind of dashed off. She didn't come back. So it ended up on the cover. So once this story was published, there was we started this Afghan Girls Fund, Afghan Girls Fund, to raise money for girls' education. So this is the school, which was started and funded by her picture, basically. And so, anyway, So it was actually a wonderful kind of end of the story that we were actually able to kind of help her and give back to her, compensate her for the use of the picture. And it was really a kind of a win-win for everybody. I mean, she wanted education for her children, and that was kind of provided for. Her big dream was to go to Mecca and perform a Hajj, and National Geographic sent her and her husband. And then she said, well, I want to send my brother too. And so the brother got in. And then they started realizing that they ended up being like 10 people in the in this sort of... I'd be happy to answer any questions. Anybody has a question about the pictures, or I probably should have left it on in case there's any questions. But are there any questions? Yes.
I'd like to ask about the way you work. Do you have an assistant with you all the time, or do you use local guides?
Well, I always use a local person, excuse me, who speaks the language and knows the way around, especially in Afghanistan. It's so important to have somebody who understands the culture, and if there's a problem, that you can get yourself out of the problem. But even in India, I always have somebody that can help me, especially if there's a problem. If there's a problem, you want somebody there that can speak the language. It's not so much of a problem in places like Burma, because everybody's so kind of chilled out, and it's all very... But especially places like India, Pakistan, Kashmir, Iraq, things can go terribly wrong, and you don't want to be stuck on the street. They want your film, they want your camera, they want to kill you. it can escalate really quickly if people think you're doing the wrong thing. Yes, sir.
Have you ever been in danger?
Well, actually, it's funny that the time that I was in the most danger was in Slovenia. I was doing some aerial photography, and the plane I was in, it was a two-seater, and the plane actually crashed into this lake, a place called Lake Bled, very beautiful, scenic lake. And I suddenly found myself, we were about this far off the water, and I turned to the pilot and said, I don't think we need to be this low. Because, you know, obviously you're in a plane, you want to be up. Anyway, we got, the wheels got caught in the water, and we crashed and flipped. And then I was underwater, I couldn't get the seatbelt off, couldn't breathe. It's like February, it's cold, I couldn't see anything. And some miraculous way, I was able to crawl underneath the seatbelt and get out. But that was probably the time that I you know, if you have that realization, you have that, you know, oh, I'm going to die. This is, you see it. You think, wait a minute, this is not what I had in mind for today. Because you actually see it, and you think, I'm not going to make it. Because I couldn't, the seatbelt was not the usual, like a car seatbelt. It was some the guy from, you know, was Yugoslavia at that time, 1998. He had made up this thing. I couldn't figure out how to get it off. Anyway, that's yes.
Yes, ma'am. Do you take photos to document people or events, or do you want to deliver some kind of deeper message or theme?
I think you can do both. I think you can. You know, I think that what you want to try and do in a portrait, or a portrait inside of a news situation or some kind of important event, I think you want to tell the story of that person and tell a human story, tell what it's like there, and convey some sense of the enormity of what's going on. I think it's all going through your mind simultaneously, and a lot of it's just instinct and reaction and intuition, and you're kind of kind of on autopilot to some extent, but you want to make, you know, compelling, profound pictures, and you're just sort of, you know, flying by the seat of your pants in a way. It's all kind of like happening so fast you can't even sort of think about it. You know? Until you get back later looking at the pictures and editing, and everything seems so still and quiet, and all that confusion and chaos is, you know, when you're in the moment, the things are just coming at you so fast you can't think. Yes.
How much do you plan or read in beforehand? How, on which grounds do you decide what you are going to be interested in?
Well, most of the time it's things that I've already experienced. I spent 2 years in India, and I went everywhere but on the train. And I spent 2 years in the two different monsoons. So the monsoon was something I actually had lived through. And so I thought, this would make a great story. In fact, the story, the monsoon story, had been done back in the early 60s by another photographer. I thought, I'll just reinvent, you know, that same story. And the train story, I had actually read a book by a travel writer named Paul Theroux, and I thought it was one of the, you know, great book. And since I had spent so much time on the train, I thought I'll propose that to National Geographic. So, and then I was just had traveled through Kashmir. So all the places that I was proposing stories were places and situations that I'd actually kind of lived in or lived through. And once or twice, I proposed Yemen, not having been there, but I had seen a lot of pictures and wrote up a couple pages, and they gave me the assignment. Yes?
You talked before about giving back to the, well, in this situation, the Afghani family and their community through setting up the school, and that. Is there other situations that you have done, though? Also, is there any situations that you have seen your photos so many times you bloody hate them? And the other one is, what was the encouragement you to take time off?
I never get tired of looking at my pictures. there are some pictures that I don't want to look at again because they're so bad. I mean, we all take, I mean, you know, most of the time it's not working, and it's always painful to go back and look at situations which haven't worked in the, you know, otherwise, but you got to weed through, you know, 90% of your work to find those, the gems, you know. And I think just if you realize that 80 or 90% of the pictures are just, you know, then you can, I mean, nobody's shoots great pictures all the time. But as far as, I started a nonprofit, and in fact, one of the boys in one of my stories from a couple years ago, we've contacted, and we're going to provide education. It's, for him, it's a couple hundred dollars, maybe $300 or $400 a year. It's nothing in terms of our economy, but for him and his family, it's like a really big deal. So we've sent textbooks and things to Afghanistan, and again, it doesn't require so much effort, but the result is like a really big deal for them. What was the other part of your question now? Oh, time. I go to a place like Helsinki, and no, I don't. I try and tag on sometimes an extra day. If I have a shoot somewhere, I'll try and take an extra day and photograph or relax or go to a museum or, you know, read a book or something. But I love my work. I don't feel necessity to take like a 2 week vacation and, you know, go to the beach or something. Yeah.
What is the key thing, according to your experience, when selling your idea for an assignment?
Well, the key thing is to make it as visual. Try and make them conjure up visual, try and make visual situations so that the editors, when they read your proposal, can actually, pictures come to mind. You describe situations which are very visual. Because it's easy to write a proposal, like a writer could write a proposal about a place, but they're not conjuring up images. I think if you're trying to do a photo proposal, I mean a proposal which is a situation on a photograph, you just have to conjure up images and try and make it as visual as possible so that they can actually sort of see the story in their kind of mind's eye. So I always have a list of 10 or 15 situations that's kind of described that, you know, I'm going to go here and it's try and paint a picture that makes them get excited about the potential. Because if it's not visual, if it doesn't have any visual potential, if you don't kind of hit them over the head with the possibilities, they may not kind of get it. So if it has to, for National Geographic, it has to be photographable, not just a lot of stories are great stories, but they're not, you can't photograph them. They're just unphotographable. So
when you prepare yourself to your journey and the family bit that you take with you, the digital or whatever else, and when you're working on the moisture condition, how you set your group is and last?
Well, the last two stories I've done for National Geographic were done with just this. That's all I use. I have actually a backup body, but I use basically one lens, and I walk around with one body, and that's it. That's all I don't take any. That's all. I was actually in India last week, and I was all through my camera bag, and I realized that in the past I used to take half a dozen lenses, right? But I actually realized in my camera bag I had one lens. Maybe I had a 50, but I think I just had the one lens. So all those other lenses I don't even bother with. So I just take the one. I take two bodies and the one lens or two lenses, and that's pretty much it. I have a flash somewhere. I don't know where it is. I used to take it. I have it, and I will use it if I. But I found with digital, it's so much easier to photograph, especially in low light, that it's just, I mean, now it's just so much more fun. I used to use a tripod almost every day. Almost every day, it's 6 o'clock, and I'd get the tripod out and start shooting. But I haven't actually for my editorial work, I haven't used a tripod in like years. If I'm doing a ad, I do some advertising photography, then that's different. I use a tripod and a Hasselblad and lights and the whole bit. But if it's just an editorial assignment, it's just that's it. And it's really light. Just this. I have my cards in my pocket, my memory cards, and that's it. I look like a tourist. I mean, it's a little bit, it's a kind of a big camera for a tourist, but it's, I used to have a photo vest and two cameras and lenses and all this kind of stuff. And I looked like I was going into battle, you know? but now it's just that. It's all it is. Yes.
What is a camera and a lens?
It's a D3X. And I can never keep those numbers straight. Sometimes the S's and X's and on. And then it's a 24 to 70. And I found, for me, that's all I need. I mean, I usually like to work in close. I don't like to work with a long lens and get a long. I like to work really close. And if I can't shoot it with this, then I just don't shoot it. I'm just thinking in terms of that lens. I don't think about anything wider or longer. This thing.
Yeah, I'd like to ask about the political aspect of your work. So do you think, is it important to evoke political discussion about the topics, for example, human rights?
Absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons why I was so eager to go photograph Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, because she's such an inspiration to so many people. The country is kind of a mess. I think that you can. I think it's important to step up and tell these stories and to take a stand about injustices in the world. And I've done that for years. In my books, we tend to concentrate more on, kind of humanity and more individual people kind of outside of political context and more just sort of people and how they live and how they, what they do. But I think that's an extremely, as a photojournalist or as a documentary photographer, you have to tell these stories and really step up and make a contribution.
Have you ever had to pay somebody to take a picture? And if you have done it such way, I saw in Tibet a very clever idea, which might be dangerous. It was a photographer who had pictures of Dalai Lama. And to be able to take these beautifully dressed women, she gave a picture of him.
Hmm. Yeah, I wouldn't... I personally wouldn't do that myself because, you run the risk of, getting into some kind of problem with the police or, whatever. But in terms of paying people, I think it's really a case-by-case situation. I think it's hard to sort of make some generalization about paying people for pictures. You can make a case at times not to pay, and you can make a case sort of to pay. And I think that if you really have to get into a very specific situation, because as I said, there's times when you absolutely the right thing to do is to pay somebody, and there's other times when maybe it's not the right thing to do. If you've ever been to, just to pick a extreme example, if you've been to Marrakesh, and that there's that square, that really famous square where everybody in the square is there. They're all professional entertainers and acrobats, and they're all there. That's their way they make their living. So if you go into that square, you've entered into that system where, they're providing a service, and if you photograph them, they expect to be paid. It's just, if you don't pay them, they can't make a living. That's the kind of the deal. So in that case, you're kind of cheating them in a way if you don't pay them. It's just a fact, I don't know. Anyway, there's times when you pay and sometimes. But do you agree or disagree, or what do you think?
I only noticed that when I have been paying somebody, the picture is gone. Because then they stand there with the two hands hanging and look like soldiers. And I take a picture to be polite, but I actually don't want it.
Yeah, I generally don't pay for pictures, but I can imagine a scenario where you're photographing, again, Morocco, where there's a lot of tourists, and you're riding down the road in your sort of air-conditioned taxi, and there's a little boy, a shepherd with, interesting hat and everything, to kind of stop the car. He has a like a lamb or some goat, and so you photograph him and you take his picture, and then maybe your friend takes his picture and ends up taking, you know, 5 minutes of his kid's time. And meanwhile, his goats or his sheep have all kind of run over the countryside. And so you, as you're getting ready to get back in your car, you say, thank you very much, shukran, you know. and then the boy turns to you and says, well, you know, what about a little something for me? While his goats are all kind of lost. And you say to him, oh, no, I don't pay for pictures. no, I don't. And you get back in your air-conditioned car, and this kid has no, you know, probably really poor. And then he thinks, well, wait a minute. I just spent 5 minutes with you. My sheep are all run all over the country. I'm going to have to spend a half an hour trying to get them back together. And you don't want to give me like a, you know, 20 cents or whatever. So I think you really have to think it through. And it's hard to, again, to kind of just generalize. I think probably the gracious thing to do, and probably compassionate thing to do, is to say, you know what, if I can help you with a little something, maybe give the kid a pencil or whatever. I mean, I think that's the generous thing to do.
Have you ever been in a situation where circumstances or atmosphere has gone on to nothing? Taking photos, although you have, you shouldn't take them.
Oh, you mean there's been a situation where I took the picture and then realized that maybe I had overstepped my bounds and I shouldn't have taken the picture? Or?
Well, that's a good question also.
What is your question?
But I mean, that you've been there in order to take the photo, but you notice that you can't take it. Or have you always had the ways to take the photo?
Oh, you mean there were times when I thought I could take a picture and I was told that I could not take the picture?
Or it has been too dangerous some way or unpleasant or something.
Yeah, I think that happens quite a lot where I remember being in a kind of a fierce battle in Afghanistan, and we were kind of pinned along this wall, and there was all this heavy fire and there's rockets and mortars and machine guns and MiGs flying around dropping bombs, and it was like you think you're going to die. And I thought that I was there, I could photograph, and these guys were running around, and I went over to photograph them and they just freaked out. And I thought, you know, I'm here, I'm risking my life, we could both be killed, and I'm here to photograph, to document, to tell your story, and you're telling me I can't take any pictures? I'm like, what the hell am I doing here? So that's a case where I just thought, wow, this is insane. You know, I mean, just to get there was impossible. And then you're could be killed any second. And then I can't shoot, I can't photograph. I mean, oh yeah,
Well,
tell me about
the staging photos.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, in fine art photography, of course, that's completely acceptable. In documentary photography, you know, you're photographing real life as it's happening, and that's just kind of the line between. If you're photographing, a portrait of somebody, that kind of falls into a different category. I think portraiture, in terms of staging or posing or whatever, if the picture is being presented as a sort of a portrait, then I think everybody understands that you're creating something, and the person in that you're photographing is you're working on this kind of a, you're both working on it together to create this thing. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. What's your limit?
Oh, well, no, the limit is, the limit in terms of just reportage is that you photograph what's there, and you, and that's what you, that's what you shoot, and that's what you, I mean, like in National Geographic, whatever you see in the magazine is pretty much what came out of the camera. There's a little bit of maybe color correction, perhaps, or kind of burning or dodging, but there's nothing added or subtracted. I mean, what you see is, again, what the what came out of the camera. I mean, all the raw files go to National Geographic, and the magazine works with the raw file. It, the photographer doesn't process the pictures him or herself. It's all done at National Geographic.
Yes. Have you ever lost any equipment or being robbed?
I was in a in Thailand once. I got all my cameras stolen, and I was so discouraged that I had no cameras, so I took the train back to Bangkok, and it was an all-night train. I got back to Bangkok, and I was walking out of the train, and I saw the guy with my cameras. it was like a, can you imagine? I mean, how lucky that was. And then another time I was in Marseille, and I pulled into this sort of Arab area of the city, and somebody opened the back door of the car and stole my, again, my bag. And I had the camera bag and all my stuff in it. So I decided to wait, and I met some first guy, and I said, look, I need to get my, you know, I have this really important notebook in that bag, and I'll pay you 100 francs to get my, just I just need the notebook. So, you know, an hour goes by, and he actually comes back with the notebook. And I gave him 100. I said, look, I need the bag, too. I want to get the bag back. I'll give you, like, some number. I don't know. So he brought the bag. Yeah, brought the bag back with no cameras there. But then it was just a question of negotiating, and I ended up paying, like, 4,000 francs or 5,000 francs or 8,000. Whatever it was worth. I ended up paying, I don't know, whatever it was worth it. But I generally, you know, that's going to happen. I mean, you're definitely going to lose your cameras. You're going to drop your cameras. You're going to, all that bad stuff happens. You just can't, you know, it's just unavoidable. Yes, sir.
You have seen Afghan people for several decades now. I understood that you were there in 79 first time. So can you tell us, in human terms, can you see any progress? Are they becoming more happier? Because I understand that they very try to be helped, be more happy by force, by different armies.
Yeah. Well, the question is about Afghanistan and the progress and the future, and it's got very. Very complicated, you know, the British, and then the Russians, and then the Taliban. It's just continual, you know. And I'm sure this story isn't over. I'm sure that, you know, right now the NATO and Americans are there, and probably in another 5 or 10 years it'll be a different story. I think in the countries outside of Helmand, I think your average Afghan living in the countryside, his life is basically unaffected. You know, they're farmers. You know, they don't have electricity or running water. They just, you know, they have their animals and their crops. And I think probably for 80% of Afghans, that they don't really, whether it's the Russians or the Pakistanis or the whoever, life is pretty much the same. In a place like Kabul, you know, I don't know. I mean, if anybody's guess what the future is going to bring for Afghanistan, it's I think that Afghans See, the problem is that the Pashtun tribe is the Taliban are all Pashtun, and they're the dominant tribe, and they want to control the country, and they love to fight, and they'll just fight forever. They'll fight for the next 500 years because it's their country. Right? It stands to reason that, you know, you could kill them by the thousands, and they'll still come at you because it's their country and it's their land and everything. Whereas the foreign troops that are there, they don't really want to be there. And when they're killed, British, Americans, whoever, Austria, they...
Estonians.
Yeah.
So from Czech, I come from Czech Republic, and I have some friends who are parachutes, and they were there.
But the thing is that the Afghans will continue to fight regardless of how many people they lose, whereas the more foreign troops are killed, the more those people in those countries will put pressure on their governments to withdraw. So I think in the end it's just a question of time before the foreign nations get just fed up with it and say, you know, we've spent 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, we're fed up with this thing. Let's find a way out, and let's get the hell out of Afghanistan. We spent, you know, I mean, the Americans have spent like trillions of dollars in Iraq, and for what? Yeah?
700 trillions.
No, it's not 700 trillion. No, it's not that much. But it's a lot. Whatever it is, it's a lot of zeros. Yeah. Anyway, it's a lot of money. Anyway, that's another story from it. Yes, ma'am.
Where is your next assignment taking you?
My next assignment. I'm going to be going to India. I have the last roll of Kodachrome film. You know, it's been discontinued. It's actually last June they made their last roll, and they actually gave me that last roll. So I'm going to be using those 36 exposures and actually doing a project, and it's going to be part of a National Geographic documentary. So I'm going to be doing that in May and June. Just 36 pictures.
Well, I come from India, like you mentioned that, and I saw that you had quite a bit of projects done in India, and it seems that you like the place, or you like photographing. Any special point you had in mind? Why do you like being a photographer there?
Well, I think India is a place that not only myself, but it draws photographers from. I think every photographer who is interested in travel and world cultures goes to India, goes to Nepal, goes to, you know, Bali. But I think a thing that's so that draws photographers and myself to India is the mix of religions, the range of... In India, you have extreme wealth and extreme poverty, and you have people living... You have some of the smartest information technology and all this, you know, high-tech industry, but you also have people living in villages and in places living the same way they did 2,000 years ago. So you had this sort of wide range of contrasts, and you had people, you know, all these wonderful festivals and people dressed in traditional ways. It's just, I think that if you had to pick one country which had the most potential in terms of, you know, visual richness, it would have to be India. And India was originally, you know, it was Bangladesh and Pakistan, even, you know, it was this huge region, and now it's been kind of cut up, bit up. I think that, but to answer your question, I just think that there's a place like Bombay, you have, you know, the financial district, but then you have you know, like that movie Slumdog Millionaire, this dire of the slum, which the contrast, the range, it's like it doesn't exist, I don't think, any place in the world. It's just a wild, the spectrum is just off the charts. So I think that's the, back there, please. I always shot transparencies. I mean, I probably in my whole life I didn't shoot more than maybe a few hundred rolls of color neg.
And every,
yeah, 95%. I shot some Velvia and Provia, and that was fine, wonderful film. Yeah. Oh, the workflow.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really good question. But let me talk about workflow. I'm lucky in the sense that I have a studio in New York, and I'm old enough that I have some assistants who do all of that for me. You know, Lightroom and Aperture. I don't even know what that stuff means, to be honest. I photo mechanical. The technical side of photography, I'm extremely weak in.
I mean, taking pictures, because when you are photographing film, you have those 36 shots, and when you are taking digital, you have numbers of memory cards, and you can take 1,000 pictures of one scene and then select the best. Are you taking more pictures now?
I don't think I'm taking any more pictures now than I did with film. I think when you're photographing a situation or a portrait or whatever, I think there's a, you know, there's a point when you feel that you've gone far enough, and it's like eating a meal. You know, you eat until you feel you've had enough, and then you stop. I think that I don't see any difference really between film in terms of how much film I'm shooting or how much pictures I'm shooting. I don't see any difference between the way I shoot now and the way I shoot then. The only advantage is that you can actually see the result. And if you feel that you've gotten what you're after, then you can kind of stop. Whereas in the old days with film, you never knew if you had what you were after. You could shoot for the whole after. You didn't know if the person blinked or if the color, you know, the exposure was off. Now you can look at your histogram, and you can magnify the picture, blow it up inside the camera. You can see if it's sharp. I mean, in the old days, there was no way of knowing if it was sharp. Absolutely. Whereas now you can know that it's sharp, and you can look at the histogram and see all that stuff that the histogram shows. I think we're. What time is it? What's the time?
4:37.
Okay, we should probably we'll wrap up in a minute. Yes, please.
Do you write anything yourself?
Oh.
I saw in Milan the exhibition, which was excellent. I heard the one in Savo is as good.
Yeah.
And the text was very good also.
The question is if I write, and it reminds me of people who, when I'm out there and working with the Geographic, and I go up and I say, I'm here, I'm, you know, photographing this particular thing, and they say, well, do you just take the pictures, or do you write too? You just take the pictures? Now, how did the line go? They say, you just take the pictures? Like it's somehow... I'm not, like that. That's not enough. It's like they expect you to write as well, but that's a whole another discipline, a whole other kind of thing. So, I writing is not my first preference. I feel much more comfortable with
the
camera.
The one who writes has never been in these places. I mean, I guess there are articles connected to your pictures.
The articles in a magazine?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that. That's the magazine. You have to talk to the magazine about that. But let's just do it. Yeah, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, have you obtained permission from your subjects? And do you ever have a situation where someone from the National Geographic
that
they're unhappy that the picture was in the magazine?
Do you remember a guy named Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass? There was a band in this guy. I photographed him for my story on Sunset Boulevard, and he tried to get his lawyer to stop the presses and all that kind of stuff. But but he was, he's a famous guy, he's a rich guy, and he wanted his picture presented in a certain way. But normally, I never had.
There was never an angry letter from the
past. I photographed a male prostitute in L.A., and he wrote a letter to National Geographic saying that I had actually tried to lure him, I tried to take him out to the beach and, kind of have sex with him or something like that. and that I had come on to him, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. But the letter was, and I think he wanted money or something like that, tried to extort some money. But the letter was, had been sent from a prison. So I think he had a lot of time on his hands, and he thought he would try his luck by scaring me or National Geographic into, But other than that, I can't say that I've ever had that situation. I'm sure it happens a lot, but a lot of the places where I work, people can't read or write, so there's no way. But let's take one more question, please, up here.
Just a simple question. Which one is more challenging, photographing an ancient religious grid in India, for instance, or your neighbor, a woman going to a grocery store or something perfectly so-called normal, with lots of interest in foreign lands and everything, but to our amazement,
well, I can't speak for anybody but myself. I'm more interested in exploring another culture. And again, I don't think there's a right or a wrong. I think that if somebody wants to photograph in New Jersey or Ohio or wherever, that's perfectly fine. I don't think there's a right or a wrong. I think you should live your life and photograph and create your own pictures however you see fit. So for me, I have for 30 years or more went to these places, I spent my time in all over the world, and that's my where I prefer to work. Somebody else, there's a lot of photographers who don't even leave New York City. They do all their work right there in that small area, and that's fine for them. So I think, you just do what's right for yourself, and if you want to photograph your neighbor going to get a loaf of bread or something, then I'd probably answer a question, but that's, I don't know if I, I'll just take, yes, right here, please. Well, how long do I spend on a project? Buddhism, my project on Buddhism is probably will be a 10-year project, not continually, but kind of on and off. If I'm doing a sign for National Geographic, they're usually 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, maybe 10 weeks. But when I do my own personal projects, they can go over, many years because you... A couple pictures, I was in, you pick up a few pictures here and there, and then at the end of 5, 10, or 15 years, you put them all together and kind of do a book. So it really depends. If it's a commissioned piece, obviously it has to be done, you know, fairly quickly, inside of a, you know, a month or two. And if it's for yourself, then you just, however long it takes. A lot of people spend years and years and years working on a body of work, and then 20 years or something, maybe. And maybe they're working on several books at the same time. Not just one, but they're doing different projects simultaneously. Anyway, thank you very much. I've enjoyed spending this time with you.